Hello, I'm Rick Conti. This is number 0883, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0883. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet David Bertolino, the creator of the theme park Spooky World, and he's also the author of Behind the Scenes at Spooky World. Who were the first celebrities that he approached at the beginning of Spooky World?
I called Kane Hodder, who is Jason of Friday the 13th, and I also phoned Gunnar Hansen, who is Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then Butch Patrick, who was little Eddie Munster from the Munsters TV show. Those were my first three celebrities. I hired them to be at Spooky World for the whole month to sign complimentary autographs on photos that we printed. Back then, we didn't charge for it. I know that sounds crazy now.
Juliet Faithful is the author of the novel Liar's Dice. It's the story of an identical twin sister who just disappeared. But for Juliet, there is a lot of truth in this fictionalized story.
The underground grief in a family that when a child is sent away, and it becomes sort of a source of shame and secrecy, and it isn't talked about. It sort of parallels the grief in a country, because we were living during a military dictatorship. So all kinds of atrocities were happening, but nobody talked about it. People were afraid of the repercussions.
Science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the show talking about several topics, including the retirement of Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen.
The government basically announced on July 6th that Hansen is going to pursue new professional opportunities beginning in September 2026, but they didn't really identify what his next position will be. But he did say in a social media post that he will continue to serve as a reservist with the Royal Canadian Air Force. So I think, yeah, this is kind of a major loss in experience for Canada's active astronaut corps, but it's a huge Canadian success story, and it'll be interesting what he chooses to do next.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0883, was Rick Conti, a retired firefighter. We've been friends since our early teenage years. In fact, we met playing in a Stratomatic baseball league, and we're still doing it a half a century later. Thank you very much, Rick, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. A Florida restaurant is offering a unique deal during the 2026 Florida Python Challenge. And honestly, besides the locals, did anyone know about the Florida Python Challenge? Yeah, I didn't think so. Basically, you catch a Burmese python, you get a free pizza, said Dustin Crum of Wildman's Pizza, Pasta, and Python in Everglades City.
I'm the first place in the world to accept python as currency, so you can trade in a python for a pizza. We do python toppings, python pizza, iguana, you know, whatever.
Just the fact that there's a place called Wildman's Pizza, Pasta, and Python is in itself telling. And by the way, there are health regulations to selling a python pizza, so how does Dustin get around that?
Yeah, I can't sell that stuff, you know, I just gotta give it away for free.
Alrighty then. The annual challenge hosted by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and South Florida Water Management District ended July 19th, offering up to $25,000 in prizes for hunting the invasive reptiles threatening the Everglades. Wow. With $25,000 in prizes, I wonder how many inexperienced hunters will venture out, and I wonder if there will be any situations where the python wins. A Maryland man stole a 3-month-old kitten from a pet store before allegedly attempting to rob a nearby bank with the cat still in his arms. Around 10:30 a.m., surveillance footage captured the man grabbing the kitten named Magnolia from the adoption area of a Beltville Pet Supplies Plus, then running directly into a PNC bank in the same shopping center. In the bank, he handed the kitten to an employee before passing a note to a teller demanding cash. Prince George's County Police arrested him at the scene. Store manager Aaron Kirkowski said the suspect had visited nearly every day for 2 weeks. Magnolia was unharmed, said rescue worker Stephanie Stulich of the CAT. She is looking for a law-abiding citizen with a lot of love in their heart. Really? Really? Has anybody thought that this harmless kitten is the mastermind behind the bank robbery, and this guy was just its pawn? A Houston woman has sworn off home pole dancing after a mishap flooded 2 apartments. Asha Gilbert was filming her practice on July 6th when her pole came loose from the ceiling and struck a fire sprinkler. Water quickly flooded her unit and a neighbor's below, said Gilbert.
Immediately, I'm in shock because I'm like, oh my gosh, this cannot be happening to me.
She had installed the pole just 3 days earlier. She went on to say,
it wasn't even a thought that it could possibly hit the sprinkler. We were more worried about it hitting a wall.
Her furniture was destroyed, forcing her to relocate to another unit. Her downstairs neighbor was reportedly understanding about the damage. Gilbert confirmed that she will not be pole dancing at home again. By the way, the video of the incident, which naturally she posted, at press time has been seen over 700,000 times. Apparently, everything is a video post these days, and nobody has shame. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Los Angeles area Vons grocery store remained open for hours after a customer died in the bakery aisle on July the 5th.
Clean up on aisle 7!
Supervisor Paisyon Horner Smith said corporate managers instructed staff to barricade the body using shopping carts and umbrellas while the store continued operating. Horner Smith and a colleague had performed CPR before the customer was pronounced dead. The Los Angeles Fire Department confirmed responding to a cardiac arrest call just after 7 p.m. The deceased customer's family waited 4 hours inside the store until a mortuary arrived. Local 770 President Kathy Finn said she contacted Albertson's Labor Relations Department, as that's the parent company of Vons, but received no response regarding protocols. Well, that's kind of unacceptable. They need to clean up their policy.
Clean up in all the aisles.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? David Bertolino is a cross between Stephen King and P.T. Barnum. Back in 1990, he started a horror theme park in Massachusetts called Spooky World that launched the whole horror convention industry, which allowed for the first time fans meeting horror movie stars in person. Well, now he has a coffee table book out on that very subject. It's called Behind the Screams at Spooky World, The Secrets, Scares, and stars of America's first horror theme park. David joins us from California via Riverside.com. Hi, David.
Good morning or afternoon. Great chatting with you, Peter.
Nice to chat with you too as well, sir. How did you get into the horror business in the first place? And besides that, how did you decide to open up a theme park?
Well, it was a happy accident that my brother and dad orchestrated. They acquired a joke and magic shop when I was about 14 years old. So I guess that was, in the 60s. And, one of the specialties of the shop was Halloween goods. And we sold that product year round, long before the, temporary satellite stores were created. And so at an early age, I was, creating Halloween products. At 14, I was selling them. At 18 and 19, I was creating them. And then later, our store was acquired by Ruby's Costume, our wholesale division. So I became a sales manager for the largest Halloween products company in America. And that led to, all kinds of opportunities. And many of these opportunities were just, again, happy accidents. We just had an idea of doing a hayride tied to Halloween. And that, I brought on this fellow by the name of Tom Savini, who was a huge special effects artist. And I told him what I was doing, and he just got so excited. He flew into the Boston area, and he stayed with us for months creating a hayride trail that would entertain guests at 22 stage sets and, perform these little Halloween vignettes. And that was the very start of what we call then spooky hayrides in 1991. But with Tom's vision, in 1992, we started adding on attractions, haunted houses, a collectibles museum with props and displays that were used in horror movies. And that was kind of renaissance of the, super Halloween genre movies like Friday the 13th and Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger. So all of those, the popularity of those movies, and now a place that services that level of entertainment was created. In 1991 we started, and, my partner said, if we can get 40 people a night to go on this hayride, we're going to break even. And so we borrowed $150,000 for 10 years. And we opened October 1st of 1991, and 2,000 people were at my front door for a hayride. And for the month, we had 60,000 paid admissions. So I paid back my 10-year loan in 3 weeks, literally. And that was the start of that type of event, a Halloween horror theme park, was first created.
Now, obviously, you enjoy horror. So which do you like better, being scared or scaring people?
Well, after you've scared people, it's scaring other people. You've done your job well when you hear the screams.
So tell us about the book, Behind the Screams at Spooky World. Why did you decide to write this now and not earlier, for instance?
Well, I kind of, I moved on with my life in retirement, moved to Hollywood, California. And shortly after, a documentary film crew was kind of following me around as I visited this new invention of haunt conventions. And they thought there was something to it, and so I went along for the ride, and hence the documentary Spooktacular came out last October, which is now available on Amazon Prime. Great documentary. Are there more stories behind this? And after a 2 or 3 hour phone call with the publisher, they said, oh my God, you've got to give the behind the scream story of all of these interactions you've had with building this event and all of the conversations that were, you know, led to some fascinating stuff with all of these horror celebrities that, and also I had a cachet of photographs, just an incredible wealth of gems, a couple of thousand original photographs that we whittled down to about 300. And so, you know, as you can see in the book, there's a story behind it, but it's also hand-holding through with all of those photographs, the original photographs that have been unseen by any, you know, nobody has seen them till now. And it really is a remarkable combination coffee table book about the horror and Halloween industry.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you also were the start of getting celebrities to meet the fans at Spooky World. How did that begin for you? And who was the first one that you attracted?
Well, I called Kane Hodder, who is Jason of Friday the 13th, and that series was so popular back then, and still is. And I also phoned Gunnar Hansen, who is Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then Butch Patrick, who was little Eddie Munster from the Munsters TV show. And so those were my first three celebrities. And I hired them to be at Spooky World for the whole month to sign complimentary, you know, autographs on photos that we printed. And, you know, back then we didn't charge for it. I mean, nobody was really charging for a horror celebrity autograph. I know that sounds crazy now, but, you know, year one, they were free. By year two, I said to the celebrities, look, I'm not going to pay you a weekly salary anymore, but I want you to come for the month. And I guarantee you, you're going to make twice the amount of money charging for the photograph. I mean, the autograph could still be free, but and I'll supply you the photographs at no cost. And they didn't even know what to charge. Back then, it was $10 for a black and white and $20 for a color picture, and which is a bargain. And these days, a lot of these celebrities are charging $100 or $200 for a signed photograph. So $10 back then is a bargain. But that was the birthplace of the horror celebrity making a buck, as they say, on their celebrityhood. You know, just also, Peter, a little interesting sidebar here. Last October, I was walking one of the shows. I think it was either Monsterpalooza or Midsummer Scream, the two biggest horror conventions in the world. And Kane Hodder was there signing autographs, you know, his Jason photos. And he stood up and he said, folks, I'm going to take a break because I need to talk to this guy because Jason of Friday the 13th paid for my car, but Spooky World paid for my house in Calabasas. And I found that interesting that, you know, a lot of these horror celebrities made minimum scale, but yet they're making far greater money signing autographs throughout the country.
Wow, that's impressive. I mentioned that you're a horror fan as well. What scares you the most?
Well, the political climate right now scares the hell out of me. But moving on from that, you know, I have the usual phobia of spiders and rats and, you know, stuff like that. You know, and I got over one of my phobias of mice when I created an attraction at Spooky World called the Mouse Girl. In one of the haunted attractions, we had a young lady who would smear peanut butter all over her body, and we had 200 mice that would lick the peanut butter off of her, And that was one of the rooms in the haunted attraction called Cirque Macabre. And it just freaked people out. And that was one of my phobias, but I got over it because I was around it every night watching the people screaming at the Mouse Girl.
Well, congratulations on all of the success that you've had and also the book, Behind the Screams at Spooky World. David, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, I thank you. It was an honor to be chatting with your listeners today. Thank you so much.
David Bertolino, the creator of Spooky World and the author of the book, Behind the Screams at Spooky World, The Secret Scares and Stars of America's First Horror Theme Park. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0883, and you'll find links to David's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
Back in school, I learned in science class that 63 Earths can fit inside Uranus. One day I'll be mature enough to read this fact without laughing.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm standing and singing to the rhythm of my heart for Canada. Hi, this is Mark Jordan. I'm an American by birth, a Canadian by choice. And that always puts a big smile on my face. If you adore Canada like I do, support the arts in Canada and raise our flag everywhere you go. Shop as if your country depends on it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada. A country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Liar's Dice. Plus, Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, is back to talk about space. We also have a Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. But there's lots more in Stuff File News right here, right now. A Miami woman is facing serious charges after stabbing her friend multiple times during an argument over drinking beer inside an Uber. 32-year-old Lynn Marie Zamora was arrested July 13th on aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. According to police, Zamora grew irritated when her friend repeatedly told her that she couldn't drink beer inside the ride. She then pulled scissors from her bag and stabbed him in the bicep and calf. The victim was treated at a nearby emergency room. The Uber driver confirmed the incident. Said a spokesperson from Uber, "This behavior is alarming and has no place on the Uber platform." Zamora, who is currently on probation for battery on a person 65 years or older, so she has priors, had her bond set at $7,500. I'm wondering if Zamora will also have to foot the bill for getting blood out of the back seat. Ontario Provincial Police are urging residents not to bring explosives to police stations after someone turned in an unexploded World War II grenade. A resident handed over the grenade at the OPP detachment in Ottawa on July 10th. As the OPP posted on social media, The OPP would like to remind the public that if you find such items, please do not transport them to your local police station. This could obviously prove extremely dangerous to the person bringing in the item and others around. Officials advise leaving any discovered explosives in place and reporting the location to authorities. Police will then dispatch their explosives disposal unit to safely remove them. Okay, what I want to know is, although the warning clearly needs to be done on OPP social media, through the years before social media, were people just willy-nilly bringing unexploded explosives showing up at police stations back in the day? I mean, doesn't common sense simply dictate that if you find an explosive, you don't transport it anywhere, you just call the cops? Am I wrong here? Yeah. Anyway. 60-year-old Kurt Crom didn't know why he'd been called into his supervisor's office at Ford's Louisville, Kentucky truck plant. The union bargainer arrived, said he had been fired, and explained, "They got you on video stealing a cookie." Crom said he didn't. He'd paid at one machine, and when that transaction failed, he went to a second one, bought a cookie, and ate it. Said Crom, "They were so confident I'd stolen, and then I looked at my checking account statement, and the $1.95 debit is freaking there." He said Ford explained they had zero tolerance for theft, to which Crom retorted, "If you wanted to get rid of me, you could have just asked. I'd quit." After Crom sent notarized copies of his bank statement proving he paid, Ford offered to rehire him with back pay. Instead, he accepted a job in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Ford has said they'll be changing the policy so employees will be suspended in response to suspicious payment kiosk activity, rather than being fired. Well, Ford thinks they've learned the lesson. The actual lesson: review the evidence and listen to the defense before taking action.
The switch is on to Ford, because Ford has a better idea.
Not in this case.
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
In Florida's Palm Coast, a man attempted to cheat a court-ordered drug test that backfired spectacularly on July 14th. 52-year-old James Shepard arrived for his urine screening driving on a suspended license, already a probation violation, and was immediately arrested. Deputies then discovered a homemade device strapped to his groin, a fake bladder filled with synthetic urine, attached to a heating pad, and a prosthetic penis. During transport, a deputy moved Shepard's handcuffs to the front to ease a shoulder complaint. Shepard used that opportunity to toss the device onto the patrol car floor. In-car video confirmed the contraption was his. Sheriff Rick Staley called Shepard, quote, "a pea-brain dirtbag who flushed away a second chance." Shepard now faces probation violation, evidence tampering, and fraud charges, and is held without bond. Yet one of the many reasons you really shouldn't piss off the police.
This has been the Stuff File program, asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
There was a young fellow named Chris who skated on ice with such bliss. He tried a big jump, but fell on his rump and heard the whole stadium hiss.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Juliet Faithful is the author of the novel Liar's Dice, which is the story of a young girl named Dolores searching for her identical twin sister who disappeared. While this is a story of fiction, there is some truth to it. Juliet also works as a trilingual psychotherapist and joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts via Riverside.com. Hi, Juliet.
Hey, Peter. Thank you so much for having me on.
So tell us about the truth within the story.
Well, I could tell you some of the truth. I have childhood amnesia of the time when I lived with my identical twin sister in rural Brazil. So those years, I wrote a novel which takes place partly in that small village, but that whole part was invented, even though I did live with her, and she was sent to an institution when I was 9 and a half, 10 years old. So that part is based on my own life story, but I don't remember it. So it's both true, but invented. And not, the rest of the novel is really pure fiction, except the core feelings are, you know, the kind of grief, the underground grief in a family that when a child is sent away and it becomes sort of a source of shame and secrecy and it isn't talked about. And it sort of parallels the grief in the country because we were living during a military dictatorship. So all kinds of atrocities were happening, but nobody talked about it. People were afraid to, afraid of the repercussions. So there was this outward vision of Brazil, which involved, you know, Bossa Nova and the World Cup and Pelé and all these wonderful things, and the kind of the things the regime was doing was silent. So Dolores comes of age, as I did, in that era, 1970s Brazil. So those two, you know, the theme of sending a child away, and also she is illiterate, and her mother too is illiterate in the novel, and that too is a truth, because my mother is still illiterate, and I didn't start school until I was 10. So that part I draw on my own experience, even though Dolores is a little bit older than I was, of sort of not knowing how to read and write and how that feels, and sort of the transformation of literacy and books and how they can really change a life.
You mentioned that there was secrecy, and of course you were very young at that time. When did you learn the truth?
Well, it wasn't a secret that she was sent away. It was just that no one talked about her. There were no photographs. And if I brought her up, my family would close down and say, well, let's not think about that. It's too sad. She's better off in the hospital. So it was basically just the grief that they couldn't bear really talking about her or having any memory of her. There were no clothing, nothing that reminded her. It's as if she never existed. And my understanding is that this happened not just in Brazil, but also here in America and around the world, where in the 60s and 70s, families would send disabled children away. And Jennifer Senior wrote an article in The Atlantic that won awards about the grief of finding out that her aunt also, she had a disabled aunt, and she never knew about it because her mother was too sad to talk about it. So it's not unusual that grief goes underground.
So what made you write the book now? And also, why did you entitle it Liar's Dice?
I have been writing this book for 20 years, so it isn't, I just published it now, but it took me a very long time. Partly because of the material that was, I think, difficult for me, and partly because I worked full time and was a single mom, so I just wrote on Thursday nights and sometimes on weekends when I had spare time. So I took the long route. And the novel really kind of announced itself. It felt like I had to write it. I felt a certain sense of urgency in telling this story because I knew it had affected other people, and I hadn't ever read a novel. Actually, I'd never read a novel with a disabled person in it until, I think, 96 or 97, when André Dubus wrote a collection, and there was a man drinking in a bar, and he was in a wheelchair. And that was the first time I'd seen a character in a wheelchair in a novel, so I knew I wanted to do that. And the novel's called Liar's Dice because of the bluffing. Liar's Dice is a poker game, and it involves bluffing and deceit, which are two big themes in the novel. The parents, the mother hides her illiteracy, as does my main character, Dolores. She pretends she can read and write because she feels shame about it. And then the parents are hiding their grief. Even Dolores doesn't know. She thinks her parents don't care. And she's wrong about that, but she's, 13-year-olds don't always know the truth. And what she sees is that they never talk about her, and they seem quite happy without her. Then the country, there's a lot of bluffing in the country where they project an image of a country going ahead and full of joy and celebration. And in fact, behind the scenes, the government is, disappearing people. There's widespread censorship. And so I think the title really speaks to all those different levels of kind of bluffing and deceit. And also to luck. The game is about luck, and Dolores is born an identical twin, and one of them is fine and the other one is not. And it's just a matter of luck. And the novel really does deal with class differences, because Brazil has very stark, the poverty was incredible, and it was just around the corner from the most beautiful buildings. And in the first paragraph of the novel, Dolores looks out the school window and she sees Christ on Corcovado looking at the beaches of Ipanema and Leblon, and she notices that there are certain areas of Brazil, like the shanty towns and the poverty, are under his armpits, and he doesn't seem to see them. So again, there's that theme of hiding and not looking at certain parts of reality, which echo the way that that in that era people kind of hid away the disabled and sent them away instead of kind of integrating them into society.
You mentioned that there was a lot of secrecy within your family, and you also mentioned that it took you 20 years to write this book. What was the reaction while you were writing it, or when you finished it, from members of your family who, as you said, was keeping this secret?
Well, Peter, my mother is the only one who's alive of my family, of my parents, and she's illiterate. So I always knew that she wouldn't read it. So in that way, I felt kind of safe. I think it would make her sad to read it. I think she knows that I was writing a book about my twin sister. And she was cautious around it. She didn't ask too many questions, because I think it was avoiding the grief, because it made her too sad to think about it.
She didn't ask any questions about the book, but in doing your research and in fleshing out the story, did you ask any questions of her?
I did. I asked, and often she evaded. But a few years ago, she now has dementia. And, sometimes when people are getting dementia, they loosen up a little bit. And if you catch them at the right time, you get a little more information. And I did ask, a couple of times about why did you send her to the hospital. And my mother always says, well, it was the best thing, or it was the only thing. But she did start to voice at some point a little doubt, as if like, well, we didn't know better. And the doctors often recommended it. And my mom was illiterate, so she wasn't going to question the advice of a medical doctor. And I think she felt quite powerless. The other thing we never talked about was her illiteracy. And recently I did ask her, because I realized if I don't ask now, I will never ask. And that seemed even more taboo than my twin sister, because no one talked about her illiteracy. My dad taught her how to read, how to sign her name, but that was, it was always painful to watch her do it because she would get so nervous. So it was hard to bring it up, but I asked her about a few months ago, actually. I said, "Mom, why were you illiterate?" And my mother's actually not Brazilian, she's Spanish, and she grew up in the Spanish Civil War. And she told me that during the Franco era, another dictator, he separated the schools into boys and girls, and the boys would learn to read and write, but the girls would just learn about saints and learn how to sew. So she felt it was a waste of time. And her parents were tenant farmers and poor, so she said she was more useful on the fields. So then I learned, had a little bit of knowledge about why she never learned to read and write.
Was it cathartic for you to write this story?
I think it was, I don't know if it was cathartic, but it was a way of memorializing my sister. And I think in some ways it was that I wanted to put her into the world and not hide her away. Obviously, it isn't really her. It's my imagined her, because I don't remember my childhood with her. So I had to make her up. But I did feel like I was starting, I wanted to have conversations about disability, about institutionalization. And even today, how do we deal with that? I think we don't send kids away to the hospital anymore, but there's still a long way to go towards integrating the disabled into our lives in a very easy, seamless way. And I think we could do better. So I think I really wanted to write about this to begin conversations.
Well, again, the book is called Liar's Dice. It's written by Juliet Faithful. Juliet, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Juliet Faithful, author of Liar's Dice. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the show number for this program, which is show number 0883, and you'll find the link to Juliet's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
Why is a hammer called a hammer when it has nothing to do with ham?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife by Michael Libling is not like any serial killer novel you've ever read before.
Go ahead. I dare you to figure it out before the chilling end.
Find out what it's like to be the offspring of a multiple murderer.
Locked in a room or locked in your mind, it's really all the same.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife by Michael Libling. Available everywhere you buy books.
Coming to you from Canada, a place where fighting is frowned upon, unless it's on an ice rink. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, The Ultimate Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, Canadian Jeremy Hansen, who just went around the moon in Artemis II, is hanging up his spacesuit for good.
I know, and you know, It's amazing. This guy is leaving active astronaut duty at like the best, most highest point you could ever imagine after being selected by the Canadian Space Agency back in 2009. He waited 17 years for his first flight, and he became the first Canadian and the first person from outside of the U.S., basically, to take part in a lunar mission, right? He flew around the moon in early April with his three crewmates. He traveled farther from Earth than any humans in history. He broke distance records held since Apollo 13. He's had a long, winding career, basically, even by astronaut standards. He was a fighter pilot. I read something cool that he spent like 6 days underground at a European Space Agency cave training program. He lived for a week on an ocean floor at a NASA program in 2017. It's amazing. The Canadian government basically announced on July 6th that Hansen is going to pursue new professional opportunities beginning in September 2026, but they didn't really identify what his next position will be. But he did say in a social media post that he will continue to serve as a reservist with the Royal Canadian Air Force. So I think, yeah, this is kind of a major loss in experience for Canada's active astronaut corps, but it's a huge Canadian success story, and it'll be interesting what he chooses to do next after leaving astronaut duty. There's no doubt he holds a very special place in Canadian history, though.
Would it be fair to say that with all that he has done in his past life and his service to literally the country and the fact that he has a young family, that he's probably in some way, shape, or form, having gone around the moon, is cashing in a little bit, which he's perfectly entitled to do?
Absolutely. I mean, he's in a really unique position. I think it would make sense. He has an amazing story to tell. He's very inspirational. So he could be, you know, I could see him being a consultant in the space industry, Canadian space industry. And he has mentioned that he wants to continue contributing to the space industry. So it'll be interesting as a consultant or having his own company, definitely doing media as well. Definitely something's in store for him. So it'll be fun to watch where he ends up next.
Well, speaking of the moon, there is always the possibility, the future possibility of a moon base on the moon. And if there are plans afoot to make that actually happen. And one of the questions is, how many people should staff a moon base?
And this is becoming something very relevant to NASA and the Artemis program, because after all, that's the goal of the moon program, is to build up a permanently occupied, human-occupied base on the moon. And so while they're not announcing, this wasn't an announcement of what that's going to look like, but this was a scientific simulation. So basically looking at what would be the optimum crew size, what kind of personalities, skill sets, supplies would be needed for a long duration lunar mission. And so researchers at George Mason University basically created a very sophisticated version, what I thought was kind of cool. If you know the video game The Sims, this is kind of like The Sims on the Moon version. So they basically had virtual astronauts put together, looked at their, gave them certain technical skills, physical health, coping abilities, personality types, and then they tracked things like, what would be the consumption of food, water, oxygen? How would they use, let's say, rovers? How would they do different kind of maintenance work? What would happen if there were some unpleasant kind of surprises, like radiation events or moonquakes or something, some equipment may break down? And then they ran, tens of thousands of these kind of simulations. They set out like a 3-month baseline of what would be a tour for, say, a set of astronauts on the moon. They would spend 3 months there. And they realized that 6 astronauts really would be the optimum level, where they would be able to continue to have fresh supplies every 2 weeks delivered, not too much disruptions in their in how they work from day to day. And the worst case that they came up with was 4 astronauts would be the minimum, where you get monthly resupplies and you'd maybe have more probabilities of problems cropping up with the environment potentially. But I think the real lesson here is that, six is this magic number that they came up with, but I don't think that's really necessarily what NASA may stick to. It's just that they're going to use this as a beginner guide of what would a post like this, a remote science post, be like. And don't forget, there is this whole lessons that we've learned from Antarctica, where we've been there for many decades, ongoing places where many nations have their setups, and they're permanently occupied there year round. So you can think of the number six in terms of the number of astronauts there on the moon as a useful clue. I don't think it's the final thing, though, but it'll be interesting to see when they do come up to choose those astronauts, what that crew complement will look like.
You mentioned moonquakes, and I never even considered the idea of a moonquake. Does the lunar surface have moonquakes?
Yeah, I mean, it does... It does happen. There's different reasons why they can happen. I mean, the moon was once very geologically active at one point. And there are, you have to remember, there are ongoing lunar impacts as well that can have very, localized events. And it's interesting because if you look at what Apollo did, it taught us a lot about this. A lot of our information comes from the Apollo era, actually. They actually placed seismometers on the lunar surface, and they recorded, I think, like thousands of these seismic events. So some of these moonquakes are very deep, some are shallow, and like I said, some are caused by internal tidal stresses because of the Earth's gravity pulling on the moon, and some are there caused by actual meteor impacts, which sends like vibrations, very shallow vibrations. So the shallow ones, probably these meteor ones, are the ones most concerned for future lunar bases, I would think.
And back here on the ground, for those of us who are stargazers, there is something in August that would be kind of interesting, depending upon where you are.
Exactly. And these, when we talk about sky events, there's probably something, people think about is meteor showers, comets, and eclipses. And a total solar eclipse is probably the granddaddy of all types of stargazing events. And that's coming on August 12th. Wednesday, August 12th this year is the biggest sky watching event, I think at least for the summer, for sure. That's when the moon's shadow basically sweeps across the northern part of our planet. And the narrow path of totality, where the sun completely appears to go behind the moon and the sky darkens, that path is going to cross from northern Russia, Greenland, western Iceland, northern Spain, and a small corner of Portugal. So a lot of tourists are heading to these regions to along this narrow pathway to see the total eclipse of the sun. And it's going to last for about 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes. People will get total darkness. And what's interesting is this is the first total eclipse of the sun visible from Europe since 1999. And expectations are there's going to be very large crowds, especially in Spain, where it's going to be super spectacular because the eclipse is actually happening just before sunset when the sun is extremely low in the western horizon. So it's really cool. And if you can't make it to those path of totality regions, the partial eclipse is also going to be visible across all of Europe, some of Africa, and even western parts of Asia, and even in North America, where I am in eastern Canada, we'll get to see the sun have a little bite taken out of it. So on August 12th, mark that down on your calendar. It's an amazing event.
You know, we didn't get a chance to talk more about the moon and more about the rover on the moon, but can we go to Patreon and discuss it there?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay, sir.
Clear skies.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0883, and you'll find links to Andrew's site to get your own personal autographed copy of his books.
Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll discuss a Mars rover on the moon, Blue Origin lunar lander mock-up, humans on Titan, plus Jupiter, Mars, Pluto, and more. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
An Indianapolis man is facing felony charges of criminal recklessness after police say he posted a YouTube video of himself shooting at a bag of coffee in his backyard. The social media video allegedly shows an Army veteran shooting at a bag of Starbucks coffee as a form of protest. The coffee was perched on a fence in the backyard. The alleged shooting and social media video led to criminal recklessness charges being filed against 48-year-old Eric Smith. Police say what goes up must come down. They insist that shooting a gun in a busy neighborhood is careless and illegal, said IMPD officer Tommy Thompson. When you recklessly shoot in a densely populated area, it's very dangerous and puts everyone at risk. IMPD searched the suspect's home and recovered a rifle used in the shooting. Police believe the bullet could have traveled nearly a mile and a half once fired. For his part, Smith has filed a motion to dismiss the case. He insists the charge is based entirely on speculative assumptions of hypothetical harm where no victim has been identified. Well, he's a doofus, but anyway, that's not the question at hand. The question is, why, oh why, would you be shooting a rifle in your backyard at a bag of Starbucks coffee in protest and then brazenly post it on YouTube? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0883. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0883. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg, Manitoba,
CFMU Hamilton, Ontario,
CKLU Sudbury, Ontario,
Local 107.3 FM St. John, New Brunswick,
CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?